I have been doing this, I have been in this business for so long, and I am not sure I can ever recall seeing a 48 hours like I have seen, geopolitically speaking, in the last 24 to 48 hours. I mean, it seemed like it began with us thinking we were on the brink of World War III. Suddenly, we're hearing a case of performance art, and then suddenly, within the last few hours, the President of the United States comes out and he says this.
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing. Do you understand that?
Do you understand that, Mr. President? I don't think I've ever heard a President of the United States, at least publicly, use that kind of language, and especially when you consider who he's using it against. We're going to be talking about this. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. So we're going to start right there. The President of the United States comes out, and in no uncertain terms, he seems to be giving a message to both Iran and here, well, Iran, duh, right? He's been giving messages and threatening Iran for the last 72 hours, if not the last week. But suddenly, he's giving the same message to Israel that he's giving to Iran. And that is, stop with the bombs already. But this is the same guy who just a couple of days ago was threatening to hit Iran with more bombs and backing Bibi Netanyahu and his government 100%. So what's up? First, let's listen to it again.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I'd never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel. You know, when I say, okay, now you have 12 hours, you don't go out in the first hour and just drop everything you have on them. So I'm not happy with them. I'm not happy with Iran either. But I'm really unhappy if Israel's going out this morning because of one rocket that didn't land, that was shot, perhaps by mistake, that didn't land. I'm not happy about that. You know what? We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing. Do you understand that?
He walks away indignantly, reporters shouting questions at him. So this is where the story is now. But if that's the end, we kind of need to go back to the beginning to try and set this all back up. So let's go to last night, at least last night, for geopolitically speaking, for the time in that part of the world where this was taking place, in Qatar, where all of a sudden we saw from Iran, and we have some of these pictures. I want to share them with you because it looked massive. This is what people were suddenly seeing yesterday, and we were all saying, oh, no, oh, no, Iran is going to hit the U.S. military base in Qatar. They're going to hit the Al Udeid military base, which, by the way, is the largest in the entire area, at least as far as the Middle East is concerned. That's where the United States keeps the majority of its troops and its planes. And that's what it looked like. And this is what it looked like in Qatar with where people were told to shelter in place. And this is the anti-aircraft barrage that is trying to stop those missiles from hitting Qatar. In that moment, a lot of people were wondering what was going on. But then something kind of changed. Even before this, I think those of us who were watching this, and trust me, I think anybody in my community, at least anybody who has anything to do with journalism, started looking at this, and we all went on the Googles, as we say, and on Twitter and everywhere else we could try and look for information. You started seeing that there was something odd. There were a lot of explosions in the air, but no explosions on the ground. There were no reports of actual injuries or casualties at the time, and you started to wonder, well, what's really going on? Well, here's what really was going on. It appears that Iran told the United States they were going to do this, and intentionally, in many ways, as we're now hearing the United States did in Iran, intentionally fired missiles without meaning to hit anybody or blow anything up. It was a show of sorts. Kind of like a kabuki theater. In fact, that was confirmed when Mr. Trump comes out and says this. Let me read it to you. I want to thank Iran. Yes, I want to thank Iran for giving us early notice. So Iran has just hit a U.S. military base but apparently they gave them early notice, Mr. Trump goes on to say, which made it possible for no lives to be lost and for no one to be injured. President Donald Trump. It's a fascinating development in a story like this because it means that essentially both countries were doing things for show. Well, there's another part to this story because as much as we now know that what Iran did in Kuwait was for show, it's starting to look like what the United States did in Iran, hitting the Fordo nuclear site, was also for show. Here's Professor Mohammad Mirandi from Iran explaining just that. Take a listen.
I think that the Trump regime will be gone while the Islamic Republic of Iran is still around. And I'm quite confident that the Israeli regime will be gone. And we don't know what happened in Fordo. The Americans don't know what happened in Fordo. They haven't been down there. There are lots of reports coming out now that the damage was insignificant. I think it's quite clear that the Americans wanted to make sure that no one was hurt, and they didn't block the removal of anything there. That included, of course, enriched uranium.
He's absolutely right. We've now seen the recon pics, and the recon pics seem to show that the site looked exactly the same after it was hit as it did before it was hit, and that, yes, whatever nuclear material was there was removed, and there's actually pictures of the trucks removing it, and apparently there's reason to believe the United States knew that the material had been moved, right? So now the question is, what led Mr. Trump to be such a tough guy at first and then change his tough guy demeanor? First with the tough guy part. In the United States, the president has been getting a lot of pressure, in particular from the war community. And among those who are in that community are the media, CNN and Fox News, one from the left and one from the right. Here's Van Jones, who despises Donald Trump, who is an Obama guy and was part of his administration, suddenly coming out thanking Donald Trump for starting this war with Iran. Let's listen.
I think progressives underestimate how dangerous Iran is. Iran is not a normal country. And so the question, though, is the who and the how. Is Israel going to take out this nuclear capacity by dropping people there who blow it up? Or is America going to take it out by dropping a bomb that blows it up?
Sound familiar? Iran is not a normal country. Those people are savages, and we have to go after them. After all, they're going to be attacking us. That's what CNN is reporting. Didn't we say the same thing when we called the Vietnamese gooks and when we've called everybody in the Middle East terrorists or worse and when we call Russians bullies or when we call the Chinese sneaky or whatever other pejorative we use when we describe other countries? Well, there's Van Jones, right? A progressive essentially saying that. Here's another one, John Bolton. He's on the right. He's essentially saying, good for you, Mr. President, who, by the way, he too cannot stand President Trump, but now he's with him because he's engaging in a war. Go.
I think President Trump made the right decision for America to attack Iran's nuclear weapons program. And I think we're on the verge of potentially seeing regime change in Iran as part of that. I think this is a huge change in the Middle East. It was a decisive action. It was the right thing to do. I thought somebody should do it for a long time, but better late than never.
Boy, that word regime change. Some people in Washington just absolutely love it. It is like chocolate. It is like candy for them. They love regime changes, and that seemed to be what they're doing here. Why is it, though, that the media in the United States feeds off these guys? Bolton, for example. I mean, this is a guy who pushed for the Iraq war, which is an unmitigated disaster, and yet he's on TV every night, like if he had figured something out that nobody else did when he was actually part of a disaster. Well, this is something I know a little bit about. I spent most of my years working at Fox News and CNN and NBC and Univision. I'm a part of that corporate media. I was fired for not wanting to play along with some of these things that I'm showing you right now. Here's Tucker Carlson talking with a guest just last night about what it's like to work at Fox News and CNN and those other places where you're not allowed to disagree with the war mentality, the regime change mentality. Here it is.
But you knew that when you were given sort of like, this is what we're covering on the show today, I don't see anything on here about $800 billion, like in a defense budget, or I don't see anything in here on our show. We've got a 4-hour show, but we can't ask questions about, did we actually hit nuclear weapons, or did we actually hit, is there anything in Fordo when we hit it? I don't see, you know, I don't see any of that in here. So you knew what sort of the agenda would be for the day.
Did you ever know?
But no one ever told me what to say. You know, I just want to be clear.
Right.
About that,
but it's like you show up. I'm being disingenuous because I had the same job that you had, so I know the answer to this question. But it's just people may not understand how this works. So you show up and like everything's prepared for you.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of telling you what to say or what not to say. It's all kind of written down. You're guided in a certain direction.
You certainly are guided in a certain direction. I experience what both of them are talking about. Something else happened, suddenly. Why would Mr. Trump go from being Mr. Tough Guy, I gotta take out Iran, I'm 100% behind Bibi Netanyahu, I'm Israel's president, to the change that we've seen today, where he's using the F-bomb and referring to Israel when he's using the F-bomb? I never expected that, did you? Did you expect to see President Trump do what we just started the show with him doing? It was so bizarre. One of my executive producer called me to check to make sure it was true, that it wasn't some kind of AI that was being created out there. And we had to check sources to make sure before we put this on the air that it was real. It is real. That's Donald Trump actually using the F-bomb. But why would he do that? Well, here's what I think. Last night, I was talking to a guy named Larry Wilkerson. He was my guest on this show. Many of you have seen it. Hundreds of thousands of people have already watched this because we put it on our podcast as well. But Larry said, what Colonel Larry Wilkerson told me was that he thinks if this war would continue at the rate it was going, if it continued to be, you know, Iran and Israel just shelling each other and hurling missiles at each other, the loser would be, well, here, I'll let you hear it for yourself.
I think Bibi Netanyahu's days are numbered very, very much. You know, his government was falling when he attacked Iran. They were having a vote of no confidence, and he attacked Iran. There's no doubt in my mind that the political reason, personal political reason for Bibi was to arrest that tendency to throw him out.
There's so much going on in this story. I got to tell you, as a journalist, as a guy who likes to follow news, I've never played in such rich terrain. So much here. I can't wait to have more conversations and try and better understand what is happening here. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I don't think there's a better place or a better person to do this with than Ambassador Shashi Tharoor, because he has experienced this. He has worked at the United Nations, and he's coming in now to join us to talk about this unbelievable geopolitical moment that we're all experiencing. Mr. Shashi, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Sanchez Effect. I'm Rick Sanchez. What a day. What a 24 hours, what a 72 hours, what a week. Here we are joined by Shashi Tharoor. He is one of the most important voices in all of India. I would dare say in all of the world, because people follow you from all over the world. It just so happens you're a big voice in India as well. You've been in this whole geopolitical world for so long. I just have to ask you flat out, after seeing the things that have taken place over the last 24, 48 hours, what do you make of these developments?
Extraordinary. I mean, unprecedented. I don't think we've seen much like this before. And certainly the accompanying soundtrack was not exactly what we're used to from diplomats.
Have you ever heard a president use that word?
No, sir. Not even in private. That's amazing.
Wow.
But having said that, I think in some ways, if there was theater, as you implied in your remarks a little earlier, Rick,
yes,
it's good if people can look around and say to their own guys, look, our honor is satisfied. If that's going to result in peace, let's take peace. We all want peace in the world. And to my mind, that ultimately may be what's come out of all of this.
You know, it's funny. Donald Trump is a little crazy. I think I don't feel bad saying that, even though he's my president as a citizen of the United States of America. I hear the man say and do things sometimes that make me shake my head. If it takes crazy to get these two sides to stop fighting, then I'm all for crazy.
I agree with you. I mean, I think it took a certain chutzpah, to use an Israeli word,
yes,
to actually get ahead and separate two antagonists who might just have gone on for quite some time. There was a fear, as you yourself have implied, that once Israel started this, they wanted to see it through to regime change.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as Iran was concerned, they were fighting for their very survival. The Iranian regime was. In some ways, the Trump-American intervention may just have bust the entire narrative on both sides and forced the entire situation to a close. Now, it's still early days, but I mean, early hours, actually. But if we can have the ceasefire hold, if we can all wake up tomorrow morning and find that Israel has now announced that they're reopening flights to Tel Aviv and there's peace in Tehran, my gosh, I think that people will be grateful.
Yeah, and was it performance art? Was he really angry? Was this all planned? Is he acting? I'll tell you what, let's look at this again.
Yeah.
Let's look at this with a curious eye. Here's Mr. Trump again when he came out and said what he said.
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing. Do you understand that?
You know, they call that an aside when it comes to, like, Shakespeare, right? Was that an aside? Was that something that he kind of
Was wrapping up the interview, and I think it was an aside, but nonetheless, it's not language you really expect to see on camera. Having said that, look, you made the right point. It doesn't matter what the style is, as long as the outcome is good. And an outcome of peace is precisely what the world has been craving for some time. We've got enough troubles going on. The poor people of Gaza are still being bombed. We are looking at a situation where if this expanded, it would affect a lot of things. It would affect oil supplies for much of the world.
Mm-hmm.
It would affect shipping in the Straits of Hormuz and further south. It would certainly affect the peace and security of a number of countries in the region that are vital to stability and security. I mean, Abu Dhabi, I heard that flights are being shut down. You have Dubai, you have Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar. Qatar. So there's a lot going on there. A lot of people had a lot riding on this. And all I think Mr. Trump wanted to ensure by this extraordinary choreography of being bombed in Qatar on the airbase after moving his people out of harm's way was to be able to say to the Iranians, okay, now you've got something to show. You notice the Iranians pointed out that they dropped exactly the same number of bombs on the airbase as the Americans had dropped on Fordo.
Six missiles, right.
So it's tit for tat, honor is satisfied, let's call it quits. And I think that in some ways is not a bad way of solving the problem.
It's, you know, it sounds Indian. It does. This is how you guys settle things.
We try to.
There's a pragmatism to India's way of looking at the world. Maybe it's because it's such an ancient people's that they've been through so much, they know that sometimes they have to hold their ire, so to speak. But am I wrong?
No, look, I wish we could always solve problems so amicably. We sometimes have to do it in less pleasant ways. We just had a rather nasty little exchange over 88 hours, which is a little less than Iran and Israel, with Pakistan. And the fact is that it wasn't really about India-Pakistan, it was about India versus terrorism. But that problem, when you get hit by terror, this kind of solution isn't easy. You really have to hit back.
Well, and thank God Mr. Trump solved that one for you.
Well, we didn't need persuading. We didn't need persuading.
I understand.
If he lent on the other side, we're grateful.
He took credit for it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, you know, we had been signaling from day one that this was about retribution. It was not the opening salvo of a protracted war. We had no desire whatsoever to see this thing going on. And we actually announced each day, if Pakistan hits, we'll hit. If Pakistan stops, we'll stop. So the moment Pakistan called out on the fourth day of the conflict, called the Director General of Military Operations in India and said, hey, we'd like to call it off, we said yes instantly. And that, in many ways, was consistent. So we didn't need anyone to tell us, we'd like you to stop. As far as we're concerned, we'd stop as soon as the other guy stopped.
Yeah.
Because we had sent a message in one set of raids on terrorist camps. We didn't hit any Pakistani government infrastructure, any military infrastructure, any civilian infrastructure. We just said, look, this is about terrorism. We've hit the terrorists. Now, if you don't choose to retaliate, it's over. We're done. Well, but they did retaliate indiscriminately, and we had no choice but to hit.
We see this all over the world. What's the difference between... This is a tough one. And I, by the way, my journalistic read of India's ire, I think, was appropriate. But I'll still ask the question. Mm-hmm. Is it possible to unjustly blame a state for something people in that state do who are not necessarily tied to the government? In other words, can there be terrorist factions in a government that cannot be controlled by that government? Do you get my question?
It's entirely possible, but... In that case, why do you give safe haven to these characters? Why are they allowed to run a 200-acre campus in the heart of your most populous province? Why are they able to freely conduct training camps with Kalashnikovs and worse and instruct people on what to do? And then, let's face it, we've had too many denials over the last... Ever since the Soviet Union withdrew from Afghanistan, there were a lot of unemployed radicals around whom the Pakistanis decided to turn on us on the one side and later on Afghanistan. And the truth of the matter is, the ones who were turned against us were trained, armed, equipped, financed, guided from Pakistan. Hmm. You remember the 2008 Mumbai killings?
Of course.
American intelligence and one of the European intelligence agencies both recorded the chilling voice of the handler in Pakistan giving minute-by-minute, blow-by-blow instructions to the killers in Mumbai. Where to go, what to do. It was monitoring Indian television. Say, hey, there are people hiding on that floor. Go and kill them there. That sort of stuff was going on while the killing was happening. It's very difficult for us to take Pakistani denial seriously.
It looks like the Americans or the U.S. are creating some pretty serious overtures with Pakistan. Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of that?
Well, I think the U.S. is in a better position to answer that question than we are. If it's a way of saying... Here are the carrots, and there will be sticks if you don't behave. I mean, that's fine. If it's something else, we'll have to watch and see. Look, the U.S. and India have a strategic relationship. The U.S. and Pakistan used to have an alliance in the days of CENTO and CETO against the Warsaw Pact. So it goes back quite a while, Rick. As far as the Pakistani military is concerned, many of them have been trained in the U.S., have been to U.S. institutions, have good links with elements in the military there. And there's always stories of the deep states, et cetera, and both sides having links. So we can't expect that the U.S. wouldn't have good connections in Pakistan. What do they want Pakistan to do? If they can influence Pakistan to be a responsible player on the world, if they can tell Pakistan, listen, shut down these terrorist camps, for example, they're not doing you any good, focus on your own development, we'll help you. That's a great message. We'd like Pakistan to grow and develop and prosper. We have nothing against the Pakistani people. We just don't want them to incubate and dispatch terrorists. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and you know, some of the attacks against the people in the Indian community who happen to not be Muslim are horrible. I mean, cruel. Almost like it's a historic, hateful act when I see these.
I think it was more cynical than that, because, in fact, historically, there hasn't been any such hate. There are 200 million Muslims living in peace in India and living in comfort with their neighbors. The difficulty with the Pakistanis is their ideology, unfortunately, is one of bigotry. Their general, the man who runs the country, made a speech the week before the terrorist attack, saying essentially that Muslims cannot be expected to live in a non-Muslim majority country, which is an outrageous, bigger thing to say in the 21st century, especially since there are Muslims living around the world, including Pakistani Muslims, in many, many non-Muslim majority countries. Mm. But that bigotry is so much at the heart of what they're all about, sadly, that what they sought to do with these terrorists going around asking, what's your religion, and shooting you if you're not a Muslim, that purpose was to create a backlash in India. They wanted Indians and non-Muslims to turn against Muslims in India and say, look, we were killed because of our religion, we're going to kill you because of yours. And that didn't happen. India stayed united. Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Sikhs, everybody stood together against terror. And that is India's great victory in the face of this kind of bigotry.
Is Modi too soft?
No, I think the usual charge is he's too hard, so I wouldn't say that.
On that.
But look, diversity is a reality in our country. You have no choice, as any Indian leader will tell you from any political party, and we've had lots of different parties in the office of Prime Minister in the last 30 years. Hmm. We have no choice but to celebrate, recognize, and value our diversity, whether it's religious diversity, linguistic diversity, yeah. ethnic diversity, or whatever, because that's what makes us special. That's what makes us India. That's what guarantees our democracy as well, and that's very precious to us.
That's what makes you the perfect country to represent the BRICS nations and the global South. India has become a real friend to Russia. You and I find ourselves here in Moscow. A fascinating place, by the way. Yep. Nothing like what the West thinks it is, just like the West doesn't know much about anything other than the West. But this relationship between Russia and India that the Biden administration scowled at seems now to be, if not embraced, but certainly accepted by the new administration in Washington. Did I get that right?
Well, the Biden administration and indeed the new administration have so far accepted this relationship, and they see it does a lot of good in the world. Mm-hmm. For one thing, frankly, India buying Russian oil and gas also reduces the pressure on oil prices from the rest of the supply in the world, so it's a win-win for everyone. Otherwise, if Russian oil were completely off the market, mm-hmm. and everybody, including India, was competing with a smaller amount of oil supply from other countries, the Americans would be paying more of the pump. Everybody would be paying more of the pump. So I think it's been a good thing, and I think the West has appreciated it. But that there are voices. You've seen Senator Lindsey Graham has attempted to pass a law in the Senate, which I don't know whether the Trump administration will veto, in which he demands extortionate tariffs on Russia, China, and India for trading with each other. Hmm. So these are things that are going to have to be looked at.
You do know he's absolutely batshit crazy, right?
I mean, he certainly has, shall we say, rather extreme views on some of these matters.
There's not a single war that he does not want American soldiers to fight in. And the guy's a bit of a coward in many ways. He's done so little. It's just, pardon me for saying that. I'm a journalist and I shouldn't be judging a man so harshly. But some of the things that guy, he wants to go to war with China. He wants to go to war with Russia. He wants to go to war with Iran. He wants to go to war with, it seems, every single country out there that isn't a part of his little fiefdom. And that's just, it's just the ugly American syndrome that he shows. Thank God Donald Trump is acting differently on this day as we started our conversation.
I was very, very pleased by the fact that President Trump used such strong language about peace. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, reading the Riot Act to two unruly world leaders who might be tempted to resume the conflict, that's the way it came across, right? Like a headmaster. And if it works, and so far the signs are that it is beginning to work, it's very early hours now, that if it does work, the world has much to be grateful for, because we really, I mean, that area is the lifeline of so much of the world. And I think we need to see peace dawning there. Iran is concerned, they said, right, the foreign minister said in Moscow, how can you tell us for not negotiating when we were still at the negotiating table when the bombs hit?
Exactly.
And that's a fair question for him to ask.
Well, and I think this Donald Trump we see now, sans the cursing, which I think he should, you know, my mother would say he should have his mouth washed out with soap. Mm. But sans the cursing, he seems to be going in a direction which is what a lot of people wanted him to go in. Do you think, I had Larry Wilkerson on here yesterday with me as my guest, and he said that if this thing continued, Israel was going to get its butt handed to him, using a vernacular as well, not as nasty as Mr. Trump's. Do you think Mr. Trump had a clue that was coming down the pipe and that's the reason he's trying to shut this thing down?
No, I think on
protecting Israel against itself.
Yeah, I think, frankly, all indications were that the war began with the U.S. being caught by surprise, because people were not expecting suddenly this Iran thing to happen. You remember that the mm-hmm. director of national intelligence of the U.S. government testified in Congress that the U.S. was convinced Iran was not making a bomb.
Correct.
And Tulsi Gabbard. And then the IAEA director general said more or less the same thing in the International Atomic Energy Agency. So I think the U.S. was truly caught by surprise. Then for whatever reason, they scrambled and chose to intervene the way they did, and people thought things were going to get worse. But within 2 days, they've gone ahead and turned right around and closed it down. Now, if they can keep it this way, they will, I believe, be able to tell both sides, you've satisfied your honor. And these things matter in the world. Hmm. If the Israelis feel we have dismantled or set back for many, many decades to come Iran's progress on nuclear And the Iranians say, we've sent a message to the Americans by hitting that airbase, and we've resisted the Israeli missiles hitting Tehran and so on. And both sides can say something to their own publics, so we've come out of this okay. That's the best way to end a war, when no one feels they have to swallow the humiliation of defeat.
Do you know what you're saying? Perception can be more important than reality.
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying.
It's true, Rick. It's true in international diplomacy. It's true in war and peace. Perception is extremely important. When you have a clear-cut victory for one side, there are people licking wounds for generations to come, wanting to have their revenge. Whereas when you actually spare people humiliation, when you let both sides say it, at least to their own audiences, hey, we came out of this okay, then you no longer have a casus belli for the next war. You essentially make peace, or the possibility of lasting peace, real.
It's almost like you're saying, beat them, but don't take away their pride. Don't diminish them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Don't ever take away people's pride, because they will one day want to earn that back.
Well, if Mr. Trump has figured out a way to do that, bully on him. Good for him. Let's finish up with China. I've always tried to understand what's this beef between China and India. Some people say it's just really a border clash and nothing more than that. Is it?
Well, it's part of it. We have the world's longest undemarcated frontier, which is most unfortunate because China has settled its borders with every other country, including Russia. It still has, of course, some problems with its maritime borders with some of the Southeast Asian countries. It's a different story.
Yeah.
But our border, they just refuse to see reason. And we are in a situation where they still lay claim to an Indian state that they prefer to call South Tibet. There is a problem there. And sadly, whereas there was a modus vivendi for several decades, not a shot fired in anger between the two countries since 1976, in 2020, the Chinese, in an unprovoked assault, managed to kill 20 Indian soldiers on the border, and that is something we find very hard to forgive. Now, there is a thaw, which began late last September, October of 2024, and that thaw was progressing when the hostilities with Pakistan broke out, and China unequivocally supported the Pakistanis, so I'm not sure where the thaw is standing at the moment. But let me say that China does have a huge stake in Pakistan. The single largest project under their Belt and Road Initiative is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which runs through Pakistan, including some territory that India has always legitimately claimed to be its own,
really?
All the way down to southwest Pakistan to the port of Wadar. What this means is that goods that in the old days used to have to go down the Suez Canal or the Straits, past India, through the Straits of Malacca, through the South China Sea, be offloaded in some port like Guangzhou or Shenzhen, and then transported all the way across the country by land to Western China, can now get to Western China in 90% less time and 95% less cost.
So, good for them.
Good for them.
Yeah.
And that gives them a stake in Pakistan. But unfortunately, if that stake extends to backing Pakistan uncritically, even in Pakistan's hostility towards India, and on the fact that Pakistan shelters and provides a safe haven to terrorist attacks on India, that's when we have a problem with China. If China can be a constructive force for peace, tell the Pakistanis, focus on development, we built you a great highway, make money off it, don't waste your time breeding terrorists to kill Indians, then we could actually be in a much, much better position together.
Pardon me for not knowing this, but has the Modi government reached out to the Xi government, and are there discussions going on as we speak on this very tender subject?
India, Mr. Modi reached out way back from his first days in office. In fact, he was hosting Mr. Xi in his hometown when the Chinese incursion into Indian territory happened, literally while that conversation was going on, in his very first year in office. So India's not... There's no lack of trying on India's part. As I said, in September, October, 4.5 years after they'd killed our soldiers, a thaw began. And we started talking and resuming normal dialogue and so on. And now, again, we've seen some not very pleasant attitudes on the part of China during our standoff with Pakistan. What we'd like from China is to see China play a constructive role. I mean, China was able to overcome its differences with Russia, with many other countries over time. There's no reason why they can't overcome their differences with us. We've kept open lines of communication. But if they're going to play an inimical role, if they're going to be hostile to our vital interests, and certainly not being killed by Pakistani terrorists is a pretty vital interest,
I'd
say. I'm sure you'll agree,
yeah.
Then I'm afraid we have a problem. And at this stage, we are not writing off the relationship, far from it.
Yeah.
We still talk to them, and I'm sure we want to keep talking to them. But there's got to be a bit of give on their side, too.
You are such a wise man. You are such a wise man, such an elegant man. You've got so much experience. Wow. And I understand that you're going to be sharing that with the world, that there's you're going to do a show. Just
we've had a very interesting sort of 10-part series on British colonialism in India. I've written a book on the subject now almost 10 years ago, well, no, 8 years ago. 9 years ago. And that book was basically the meat for a discussion over 10 episodes with Russia Today on British colonialism, its impact, the way it behaved, and the way it all unfolded and ended. So it's going to be interesting, and I hope your viewers will have the time to tune in and watch it.
I love the title, Imperial Receipts. It's time to collect?
It's time to collect a bit. The Empire Strikes Back. Rich, you thought of that first?
Yeah, somebody else, I guess. Made a good movie, I understand. What a pleasure talking to you,
Shashi. Nice to meet
you, Rick. You're such a wonderful man. I really, really do appreciate you sharing your wisdom. And good luck with the show. On RT, by the way, Imperial Receipts.
That's right.
And Shashi is the man. Well, that's it for us. Thank you so much for being with us. This is The Sanchez Effect. You can catch me, by the way, did you know, on a show called Journalistically Speaking. It's a podcast I do that hundreds of thousands of people are checking on this. It makes me feel really good. We'll likely put this conversation on there as well.
Great.
We do this without any corporate spin. We do this with just the facts, experience, and whatever analysis we can gather. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll look for you again next time.